I don't remember when we went around if any of you said that you really like Manny because of his jokes. I can't remember that. I'm not sure if that came out. So I don't know if I don't know how to. Oh, well then, okay. And he did hear you. That's good. Okay. Well. Well, so, you know, I'm just give you every once in a while. I might throw in a couple as we're going on. We'll see how much time, but it seemed like this is a good time. For this one time there were these three guys that were hiking, and they came to this impassable river to get across. There's no way. And they needed to, and I can't remember why. It was one of these, you know, like in desperation, we've got to get across kind of stories. And so the first man prayed to God, and he said, "Please, God, give me the strength to cross the river." And poof. God gave him these big, massive arms and strong legs, and he was able to swim across the river. But, I mean, remember, this is a massive river, and after, you know, an hour or so, after almost drowning a couple of times, I mean, that was it. He was gone. He didn't make it. So seeing this, the second man, he prayed to God and said, "Please give me the strength and the tools to cross the river." And so, poof, God gave him a rowboat. And he was able to row across this, you know, raging river. But again, after a bit of time and almost capsizing the boat, he wasn't able to make it across. And so again, the third guy, he saw how this is working out for the other two. And so he also prayed to God, but just to add a little bit to it, he said, "Please, God, give me the strength and the tools and the intelligence to cross the river." And poof, God turned him into a woman. And she looked at the map and hiked upstream a couple of hundred yards and walked across the bridge. That's the, yeah, you knew. Huh. Yeah, you knew it was going to have something to do with the bridge, right? Yeah, okay. Well. But, oh really, that women don't look at maps? Oh yeah. Oh yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, she didn't ask for directions, but she looked at the map, so there's the deal. Of course, now, guys, we can do this and pretend that we're not looking at a map. We're doing something else, yeah. Well, anyway, here's the point. It is smart to use maps, right? I mean, it really is. When you're lost, when you're not sure the right way, the right direction, it's a smart thing to look at a map. One. We've got some direction. We've got some guidance in the way that we should go, in the way that we should build a church, in the way that we should follow Christ, in the way that we should want to make a difference in the world. And so even as we're talking about bridge building, that we have to say, we have to come back. What is it that God is really calling us to do? Who is God really calling us to be? What has God really asked us to do? That God built a bridge to us through Christ, and He's given us the ministry of bridge building. 2 Corinthians 5:18. So why is all this important? Well, a few reasons very quickly. Because of the gap. We need to see the needs from the perspective of the gap. Sometimes it's so easy for us to, we have our Christian friends, we go to church, we sort of live in our holy huddles of believers, and we sometimes forget that there's a football game going on, that God has called us to get out of the huddle to live in. It's easy to forget what's going on the other side of that raging river, and it is impassable. We forget what's going on over there, and so sometimes we need to see the need from the perspective of the gap. We have to get down into our Hess Creek. Remember, you know, from the top of the Hess Creek, it doesn't look like much. Sometimes we have to get down into Hess Creek to be able to see that need for a simple, humble, yet magnificent bridge that can be built. We need to build bridges because of the gap. And don't be discouraged if there are problems, because the reality is a completed bridge always implies a challenge, a problem, and a gap, and that someone saw the need, had the vision, and refused to turn back at the problem. And that's true of every bridge. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow morning, actually, in the worship service. We need to build bridges because it's what Jesus did for us. He gave us a model to follow. We need to build bridges because Jesus is the only way. And you may be the only way that someone will hear. You know, there are lots of bridges that are all over the world. We talked about, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands maybe. You know, I really don't know how many. But there are very few that connect two continents. 1914, a man-made gap was created between North and South America. We call that Panama Canal. Exactly. And the Panama Canal is great for shipping. Not so good for walking and riding and driving across just by itself. It wasn't until 1962, almost 50 years after the Panama Canal was constructed, that the Bridge of the Americas was built to span that gap. It's almost 18 football fields long. It remains the only intercontinental bridge in the Western Hemisphere. This is the only way to drive from North to South America. If you wanted to drive today to Venezuela, you're driving over that bridge. That's just what you do. It's the only way. Jesus is the only way that we can be reconciled with God. And for some people, you, this is the sobering and exciting part of this. For some people, you are the only way that they will hear about that bridge. We need to build bridges because it's what God told us to do. Wow. You know, I am a parent of four kids, and I have to tell you that just because Dad said so, it doesn't always work for some reason for my kids to obey. We had to learn some other things, some parenting techniques, you know, all the rest. But as parents, what is one of the things that we wish, that we desire? It's for our kids to simply do something because we, loving wisdom, said, son, daughter, this is something that's good for you to do. It's something you need to do. God told us. He defined the way that He described the ministry that He gave to us was in bridge-building terms. And so, it really is who God has called us to be. He's called us to be bridge-builders. There are a few questions here, just to like you to think about. Get the third one up there, okay? Let's see. We are not organized very well in tables. Ray, you could have a great discussion all by yourself, and you could come to great unity. Maybe. I don't really know you that well. yes, okay. So, Ray, I'm going to ask you to go to another table. How are right behind you with Brianna and Jenna there? Okay, very quickly. I'm not going to give you much time here, just about 5 minutes. And you're not going to be able to get through all of these questions, but at your table, I'd like you to talk about these questions. What are some other reasons we're important to build bridges? You know, just hang on that just for a minute or so. But what are some ways that Bangor Liberty is already building bridges? And then see how far you can get into that third question of what else could we do to build some bridges in the future. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in this next session, but I'd like you to start thinking about that and talking about it. What are some other reasons? Just take a minute on that one, and then jump into the second one. What are some ways that our church is already building bridges? And the third one, what is something else we could do to build some bridges in the future? Okay, the one who's going to lead your discussion is the person whose birthday is closest to today. So you have to start with figuring that out, too. And I'm going to give you, you know, five. Today is the day? Joe, happy birthday. And I understand we're having a great celebration for you today, 80th birthday. That is, let me tell you, you have, way to go, Joe. Happy birthday. Wait, has anybody sung happy birthday to you yet today? Okay, we need to. Okay, would you join me? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Joe. Happy birthday to you. Hey. There we go. All right. Thank you. Okay, jump into these questions, give you, 5 to 7 minutes here. Okay, if I could get your attention back up here, please. Sorry to interrupt those of you that are still talking, but good job on talking, since that's the assignment. Very quickly, don't have time to hear reports from all of you, but the second question, what are some ways your church right now builds bridges effectively? What's happening? Just very quickly.
House of Compassion.
House of Compassion. And I might not know the explanation behind all these, but I'm going to assume that you all know. So, Food Bank, House of Compassion. Actually, we drove by that. Okay, and I saw the sign out front. Very good. PBS. Ah. Oh. Okay.
Helping hands in the community. We've gone out and done yard work and cleaning and things for some people that are in need.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it themselves, either from elderly or handicapped or whatever.
Great. What else came to your mind? Anything else mentioned? Good. Anything?
Just had a kind of an outreach day at Farm Progress Day Center.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Good. So do you notice, I mean, very quickly, in less than 5 minutes, you're able to think of actually a bunch of things that are going on here. And this was like an hour-long assignment. You would come up with more. I'm forcing you to be brief on this. How about on this last one, anybody come up with anything just right immediately off the top of your head that you thought at your table, here's something that works, or maybe we should think about, that you would be willing to just throw out there. We're not going to say whether you're going to do it or not. These are, if it hasn't happened yet, it means, these are just things that are out there, possibilities. Anybody come up with anything?
Well, one thing was that when we focus on the service, like providing food, providing the labor,
Mm-hmm.
When you provide a meal, have people designated to sit down at the table to just visit, that being their job. When we go to somebody's house to do yard work, have somebody stick around after just to visit.
So the food or the yard work is the bridge. We need to remember, though, it's about the people and making the relationship connections. Good. Okay. Chris, did you? Mm-hmm. Instead of people coming to you, you going out to where they are for something. Which, frankly, is why VBS was started in the first place. It was 100% about outreach. Interesting. Okay, good. And I realize, this third question here that I'm asking you right now, to share, it's a little bit risky because, number one, some of the ideas maybe you don't have complete unity on yet. It's also risky because you know what happens if you're the one in a church who says, hey, let's do that. Yeah. Sure, as long as you're the one who's willing to head it. Yeah, so I understand there are all kinds of, this sort of risky question, probably halfway unfair for me to ask you even to reveal any of these things publicly. So thank you. But I'm not going to take any more time to do this right. I wanted us to start thinking about this, because this is where it's going. This is the whole idea, is that it's one thing to sit and listen to a guy talk, or even, you know, watch videos and think about stuff. It's another thing to say, well, how are we going to put some feet to this? What are we going to do? How are we going to put some legs to this so that there's some traction and some action that happens as a result? So underneath all the things that we're talking about, I hope that that is a part of that prayer. Lord, help me to be open to what you have for me. A part of that is, Lord, help me to be faithful to respond in faith and obedience to whatever it is that you have for me. The action traction stuff is a part of where we want to go with all of this. I'm going to shift over here to a different PowerPoint, I hope. Because where this is going is, I want to share with you some, think of these as some practical principles and concepts and skill-building kinds of things that start here. They do start with our ideas. They start with our mentality and our understanding about different kinds of things. And so, in the rest of our time before lunch, and then after lunch, we're going to talk about some building skills. And first of all, it's this part right here. It's making connections that make disciples and make a difference. I mean, because again, that's the whole point. It's making a difference in the world for Christ. And that means, fundamentally, it is about making disciples. Again, the theme verse that we're talking about, wait a minute, that's not, how did it flip back to that? Okay, let's try this again. This is that paraphrase of 2 Corinthians 5:18. Actually, this is the text from NIV, that God reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. And the paraphrase, that God built a bridge to us through Christ and gave us the ministry of bridge building. This is the motivation. This is a part of the why. By all accounts, Jesus cared for people. He was concerned about others. Here's what he said about this. Cared about people, concerned about others. Obviously, I mean, it's Jesus, right? What I mean by that is that he didn't just care for people in general. He cared for people specifically. As individuals, he cared about people. One of those places that reminds us of that is Matthew chapter 5. And you know this passage. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, is where Jesus said these powerful and penetrating words. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its salt, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You're the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. You know, I live in Haviland, Kansas right now, and so it's kind of funny to think about putting a light, you know, up on a hill, because there aren't any. At least you have a few hills around here. Well, that's true. We could put one up there, and that would be high. That's about it. In fact, I shouldn't even say this, because I'm making fun of the place where I live. But there's a postcard. Some of you have been there. There's a postcard for Haviland, and actually, there's nothing there. It shows a field and sky, and way off in the distance, you can see the little speck. It's the grain elevator. So that's the Haviland City postcard. But the point is, we're the light of the world. You don't put a lamp under a bowl. You put it on its stand. It gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, it says, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Jesus said, in the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Now, here's the interesting thing about this passage to me as I think about it. As Jesus speaking those words about being salt and light, his encouragement to stay salty, to stay bright. He wasn't talking about staying salty and bright just for the nameless, faceless masses. There were specific individual people that Jesus knew his disciples had relationships with. Salt impacts flavors, preserves, whatever salt is going to do, it does it with things that it comes in contact with, not things that salt doesn't have contact with. And so it's all a close proximity kind of gig. That's what it is. And light that shines, when you turn on a light in this room, it doesn't shine in the sanctuary. It shines in this room. And so there's something very particular and specific about what Jesus is saying when he's saying about being salt and being light. Not just nameless, faceless crowds, but specifically people in our community. Jesus cared about family and friends and people in our neighborhoods who would see our light, taste our salt, would have connections with us. That is actually what Jesus is urging his disciples to do, to have an impact right around you, around and with the people that you live and who see you. To be salty and bright. There are some things, though, that we need to be aware of. There are some things that we need to do to build and maintain effective bridges. And I've got another interesting kind of bridge video here. And I'm just going to throw it out there that this is one of those things as a pastor where, I don't know why, you feel like there's some videos you don't show in a worship service, but they're okay when it's not. And I have no idea why that is. But I'm just confessing that I'm guilty of that sense. So there is a swear word that gets thrown out here. I'm just going to let you know. And why would I not show this in a worship service? I don't know. Why would I show it to you? I don't know. But anyway, I'm just so you know that I know that one gets thrown in there quickly. But don't let it, don't get lost on that for the rest of the thing that is shown here.
Diego. According According to the watchdog group Transportation for America, it's structurally deficient. At 44 years old, it shows cracks in its deck. The North LaSalle Street Bridge in Chicago also makes the cut, showing its age at 85 with advanced deterioration. And there's even the iconic Brooklyn Bridge at 129, one of the oldest in the country. It needs new ramps. But the scariest of the scary, LePatner says, is New York's 3.5-mile Tappan Zee, still carrying thousands of commuters every day, 7 years longer than it was built for.
What's wrong with that bridge? What's happening?
Well, it was designed in the late 50s on the cheap and without the necessary engineering to ensure its long-term stability.
How often do you drive across the Tappan Zee?
I will never go over that bridge.
You won't drive across that bridge at all?
A ride under the massive superstructure with Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino.
I mean, look at the rust. You see the rust over here along the whole roadway.
He admits it won't win a beauty contest and is pushing plans for a replacement, but insists the Tappan Zee is not about to fall down.
For the average person, you look at that and say, ooh.
Right. That looks creaky.
That's creaky. That's scary. So I get that. But, you know, when the inspectors come out all the time, we're relying on their information, and if they continue to deem it safe, then we have to assume it is. But the day that they come and say it's not is the day that we're in for big trouble.
Are you worried, though, that some people might look at you as Chicken Little? The sky is falling. The sky is falling about these bridges.
I never want to be in an interview with someone like you or anybody from the media the day after the next bridge fails and say, I told you so.
Fixing the nation's bridges will take time and cost billions of dollars. But for now, commuters like Lauren Reyes are thankful they made it across today.
And now we're on the off-ramp and I'm good to go. I can start relaxing again.
But there's always tomorrow.
You can find a list of bad bridges across the country. Is there one in your town? At abcnews.com/2020.
Okay. I have never done that. Come out. I guess the point is that past, that doesn't mean that there's nothing that can be done to help that bridge even be more effective, more stable, continuing to function today and in the future. And that is true for every church that you know. There are things that we can do to help it continue to be effective in the future. There are a lot of different models, things that we could be talking about here today. For the next number of minutes, I want to acknowledge a guy named Charles Arne. Chip Arne is a friend of mine, Southern California, president of the American Society of Church Growth. And I've adapted at least a few of the things I'm going to share with you right now from some things that he has written about. And I've added to it and changed a little bit. But some helpful things, some six really essential principles when it comes to bridge building. And the first is to have this clearly in mind, that disciple making is the real goal. The longer a church exists, the more it can become concerned with self-preservation, and the less it can become concerned with its original purpose. I was in a class at Berklee College this last year, and I asked, and there were maybe 25 students in the room, I asked them, how many of you have been a part of a church plant? And there were one or two who raised their hands. And I said, oh, really? How many of you have a home church? How many of you have ever been in a home church? They all raised their hands. And then I asked again, okay, how many of you have ever been then in a church plant? And by now, a few more caught on, about half the room kind of rolled their eyes and raised their hands. But they were starting to get it. You see, the reality is every single church was once a church plant. Every single church that exists was at one time started through probably great effort and great prayer. And maybe fasting, and maybe great sacrifice, maybe great costs, including this one, including liberty, including the coming together, including the stuff that the churches that existed before the Bangor Friends Church that led to the planting of this church. Sacrifices, costs, prayer, blood, sweat, tears, all of the rest, to say nothing of money and resources, were all spent. And yet, as time goes on, every congregation, every group, moves, gravitates in the direction of self-preservation. The first priority really is a reminder to turn ourselves away from whatever distracts us and back to our primary goal, Christ's primary goal of making disciples. You know Matthew 28. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And lo, I'm with you always, even to the very end of the age. Why would Jesus feel the need to remind his followers that he was with them right at that point? Well, it's probably because he knew that if we really took seriously what he was saying, to go and make disciples, that a lot of us would go, you know, kind of heavy sigh, big gulp. Really? Yes, that's really what he's asking us to do. But he's also promised to be with us. How can we keep it our number one priority? It's through prayer. It's by thinking about it, by doing things like we're doing here today. You know, taking time, pausing to get down into the gap and to look at that need again from the perspective of the gap. Charles Arne put it this way. He said, a church can do many things. A church should do a few important things, but there's only one essential thing a church must do, and it's make disciples. Well, a second really key priority is to understand that social networks create a path. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, in the jungle of making disciples, you are the pathway. This is something that any congregation can do. And we're talking about what can you do? This is something that any congregation in this country can do to reach more people. Because the reality is non-Christians come to Christ and the church primarily, first and foremost, not through our programs, not through our stuff, but through you. It is that simple concept of friends reaching friends. That's it. It's not gimmicky. It's not stuff. It's people. It's relationships. Did you know that Christian friends and relatives bring twice as many new believers into the kingdom as all the other reasons combined? It is who you know. It's the connections, the people, relationships. Now, what's one of the dangers? When you've been a Christian, oh, I don't know, let's say all your life. What's one of the dangers that can happen? If this is the way that people come to know Christ and disciples are made, what's one of the dangers if you want that to happen, if you personally have been a Christian for 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 50 years? What's one of the dangers? How about you relax?
Give up on certain. I've had a friend for pretty close to 40 years and tried to minister to him over the years. I think there's been times where I've quote unquote given up. Said, hey, just, you know, he's not going to accept Christ.
Wow.
That's not a good idea.
Rick, you're right. That is one of the dangers. And there can be a lethargy, there can be a sense of distraction. It hasn't happened in 40 years, it's not going to happen tomorrow. So that we can lose that sense of urgency as time goes on. What else can be a danger if you've been a Christian for any length of time that hinders this right here? If social networks create a path, and you've been a Christian for a long time, what's one of the potential dangers that hinders us from reaching people for Christ? Margaret, you nailed it. That's exactly right.
We're not in the world enough.
Going into a sinful situation to not be around
the sin. Say that one more time, Brian. The fear of
going or being
So we want to stay, we want to avoid that bad stuff, right? We want to avoid the bad influences. I mean, what did our mothers tell us? Don't go there. So we don't. That's right. Okay, so one of the dangers is that we become isolated and no longer have those networks of friendships with non-Christians. Okay, and one of the reasons why that can happen is because we're dutifully obeying our mothers and or whatever. We're not... It's the fear of the negative influence happening this way. What's another reason, though, besides fear, that might cause us to not have any non-Christian friends or relationships? One is fear. Yes. And why do we do that? Right. We look for our commonalities, don't we, in any group. I mean, Mike and I, how long did it take us to start talking about Quaker history last night? You know, oh, that fast? Yeah, right. You know, we do that kind of stuff. Look for commonalities. And if you're in a strange group, whatever... Yeah, okay, so our comfort zones. What else might keep us from having a bunch of unchurched, non-Christian friends? I got burned. Difficult things can happen out of that, yes. And maybe a couple there. Fear of criticism, others judging us. Is that kind of what you were meaning by that? Yeah. What are other people going to think? What about, okay, how about this one? I have all of my Christian friends. You have your network of friends right now. How do I add anybody into that network of friendships? Time. And what if I do? Literally, something has to give. And I love all the friends that I have. I don't want them to criticize me. Maybe they're not going to criticize me for, you know, being tainted by the world. Maybe they're just going to be critical of me not hanging out with them as much anymore. I don't want to lose that. I don't want to lose those friendships I have. Somebody else can build those bridges to the unchristian friends, unchristian, unchurched people in the neighborhood. Because I don't have enough time. I don't want others to feel bad. How about this one? Okay, we're thinking about some of the negative things. I want to suggest to you that there potentially is a good, bad reason. How about this one? I've been a Christian for 40 years, and I started out with a bunch of non-Christian friends, but guess what? Over time, they've all become Christians. I mean, this is a fascinating thing. I've talked with people over the years, many, for whom that is exactly their story. They are evangelists by heart. But as time goes on, the people that they've known have come to know Christ. And slowly, as time goes on, and we want this to happen, right? What does the Bible say? Love one another. Think about all the one another passages in Scripture that are focused on the body life of the congregation. That is a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But when we do that exclusively and forget our ultimate purpose of making disciples, forget to let our drawbridge down and go back out into the community and to build more bridges to more people so that, guess what, we might have to knock down some walls. I mean, here's another reality. If all of you won 10 people to Christ this year, man, what would happen to Bangor Liberty Friends Church? I mean, seriously, that is serious stuff. What would happen if Bangor Liberty Friends Church was twice the size? What would you do if there were 200 people coming to church here every Sunday, 1 year from today? Think about how that would impact your committees. Think about how that would impact your leadership structures. Think about, some of you have to give up some of your current friendships. Not that you don't still love them, But you'd have to, when I say give up, what I mean is you'd have to not hang out with them as much. Not that you don't love them, you care for them, but it's a missionary mentality right in your own backyard that says, maybe I can establish some new networks of friendships right here. Social networks create a path. Christian friends and relatives bring twice as many new believers into the kingdom as all the other reasons combined. Let me, I want to share with you four, I might even slip in a fifth idea, something practical that you can do to build off of this principle right here. This first is from a church, Glenkirk Presbyterian Church in Glendora, California. I've been there a couple of times. This is something that they practice. It's praying for one person at 1 o'clock for 1 minute during a month. One by one. It's the 1-1-1-1 approach. One person, 1 o'clock for 1 minute during one specific month. And then it's inviting those people to church during that month. At the church where I was at, a pastor for 30 years, we did something that we actually borrowed, adapted from the Southern Baptists. Elmer Towns, 25 years ago, put together some material that he called Friend Day. Are you familiar with that? Friend Day or Friend Weekend? When I saw it out of the Southern Baptists, I thought, man, why didn't we think of that? I mean, it's our name. It's not Baptist Day. It's Friend Day. But anyway, we adopted that and adapted this. Here's the concept, is that you have ask everyone in the congregation, it takes about a month leading up to it, to list on a piece of paper the people that they know who don't know Christ yet or aren't involved in a church or they think might not be involved in a church. You don't have to know it for sure, but you think might not be. And you literally write their names down. We would call it the 10 most wanted list, that kind of thing. You write the names down, and even if you don't know their name, it might be the person that is at the grocery store that checks my groceries when I see them, or the person at the gas station. You might not know their name yet, but it's somebody that you see. It might be the person who lives down at the end of the block that I haven't met yet. So you don't always have to know the name, but you write these names or, you know, who they are down on the piece of paper. And you do that on one particular Sunday. You invite people to do that during a worship service. And then, and by the way, we have testimonies each week of people who have come to know Christ or have become involved in the church because of the influence of a friend, or a testimony of somebody who has invited a friend, taken a risk, whether that friend came to church or came to know Christ or not. It's sharing those stories is an important way of encouraging one another. So each week, there are the testimonies and stories. The first week is the 10 most wanted list. The second week is the prayer promise agreements. Are any of you familiar with the faith promise method of missionary giving? Promise giving? Not something you're familiar with. Okay. I was going to say that prayer promise agreements are like that. That doesn't help you. A prayer agreement is where we would put a card in the worship folders, in the bulletins, and on one side of the card you keep, the other part you tear off and turn in. And what you write down, we've been asking people in the congregation to pray, and then what they do is they write down on both sides the name or names of people that God has put on their heart from their 10 most wanted list that they would pray for specifically for the rest of that period of time that they would come to know Christ and come to be a part of our church fellowship. And that's what you're praying each day. And you keep half of it. The other half you turn in, and there's a prayer team. For us, it was our pastoral staff, but for you, it might be your ministering council or another leadership group. And there's a commitment to pray regularly as a prayer team for you as you're inviting and for those unchurched, non-Christian friends or family members or community people that you might know. And so there's a commitment. You where you are praying and you have a prayer partner praying with you for your friend and praying for you. And what you're praying is that God will open a door of opportunity. It's the Colossians chapter 4 prayer where Paul is praying and inviting people to pray for him and praying that a door will open for the message. That's what Paul was praying. And then it's all leading to a designated day that you call Friend Day, and you put your best foot forward, you have your best music, whatever special kind of, you have special food things usually as a part of that day. We would have special luncheon and special things for kids. Anything that we would think of as special, we would have that. So it's kind of a party kind of a day. And the idea is that people would pray for and then take that step to invite somebody to that day. What I can tell you is that every year, and we did this for, 20 plus years, and every year, that was the most well-attended weekend for new people who had never been to our church of any day in the year next to Easter and Christmas Eve, which we would have 5,000 people coming to our Christmas Eve services. So it was usually third on that list, but sometimes it would even be number two in terms of the most well-attended unchurched person day of the year. Why? It wasn't a gimmick. It wasn't like we didn't have a way of $1,000 if you show up. Yeah, it wasn't that. It was everyone in the congregation praying and taking a step to invite. Now, not everybody that was invited came. I invited people every year, and half the time, the person I invited came. Half the time, they didn't. But I can tell you that there are some people who ended up giving their hearts to the Lord because of people that I ended up inviting and that other people ended up inviting and who are active leaders in that church today. There's something about everybody being on the same page, praying, taking a step. Actually, it is a discipleship growing experience for every person, in some ways, even especially for those for whom their friend didn't come. Because it's all of us. It's not about the results. It's us being faithful to do our part and then trusting God with the results. That's a thing. But it's using social networks to create a path. Now, what about if you really don't have a relationship with somebody who doesn't know Christ or who isn't involved in a church anyplace? What do you do? Well, Andy Stanley has this little three-part method. It's sort of a simplified version of even the Friend Day idea. It's praying, investing, and inviting. So you pray for someone, you invest your life in them. So you go and, hi, I'm your neighbor from down the street, and just wanted to introduce myself. Here's some cookies. It's taking the... And like Margaret and I were just talking about, what do you do when you meet somebody, you very quickly try to find out what is the connecting point. What do you enjoy? And so you find out, oh, they like the NBA? Fantastic. Well, guess what? NBA season is starting in October. Why don't you come over to our house? Let's watch a game together. Oh, find out that they like football? Great. Well, you know, the NFL season, you know, what do you think about that? Let's watch a game. Does it have to be your first love? No. It's just like you having a relationship, guys, with the girl that you wanted to get to know. You find out what they like, and then you say, hey, well, I'm willing to go to that chick flick with you because, you know, I want to have a relationship with you. It's about the relationship, not about the chick flick, that we do some of those kinds of things. And girls, some of you have, been willing to go to the Big Bang shoot 'em up kind of movies, you know, over the years because you wanted to connect with the guy or whatever. You know, it's finding out what they're interested in and then you invest your life in them. You find out that they like, you know, working in the garden. Well, you know, get out your shovel and go pick some weeds with them. That it's investing your life, and then it's through that investment of life. That's the bridge that you invite. That's Andy Stanley, and I can tell you that's a great little relationship building concept. This is Bill Hybels' version of all of this. He talks about living in 3D. Develop friendships. Discover stories. So you have to talk with them. Find out. Discover stories. And then discerning appropriate next steps. This is his, think of it as lifestyle evangelism approach. It's a led by the Holy Spirit approach, but where we are willing to take steps and risks to develop some of these relationships. Well, let me go on from here. Felt needs are a connecting point. Felt needs. What do I mean by that? It means the need that your neighbor down the street has on their mind. Most unchurched people are not walking around thinking about the gospel and its implications. Most people aren't. Maybe there's somebody, but most people are not. But most unchurched people are thinking about something that they care about. They are thinking about their jobs, their friends, their health, their kids, their finances, their hobbies. They are lamenting that Dwight Howard is going to the Houston Rockets. Some of you didn't know. I am a Lakers fan, and so that's deeply grievous to me. I just read that this morning. But there are things that people care about. And so it's finding out what are those things that people care about and then using that as a point to connect. We need to show unreached people that how what we are doing in the church is relevant to them. To them. Think about Jesus in his conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well. At that point in time, she was interested, at least on the surface, in water. So, yeah, he can go there. He talked to her about water. He also knew there was a deeper need. And eventually got to that, saying that, I know you're not married, and the man you're living with now, you know, it's not your husband's. You've had multiple other husbands. He knew that there was some relational brokenness in her life. Well, and so it's finding out what are the felt needs and being willing to go there. Neil McBride, he wrote about and summarized some needs of people today. He said that people feel disconnected and isolated. That's a need. They're looking for a place to belong, a place to be a part of a family. That's a need. He said that people are feeling the pressure of a busy and stressful world. And so they're looking a way to manage their stresses and their priorities. That's something people are looking for. So the people sense the shallowness of superficial encounters with others. And this is something that's especially true for emerging generations that are looking for authentic relationships. Not phony stuff, but it really is genuine caring. People, there's another need that Neil McBride identified, is that people are feeling empty and drained from striving to meet their desires through work, material possessions, and entertainment. So what they're looking for really are spiritual answers to their unfulfilled hunger. You have what people are looking for. Believers in Christ have what unchurched non-believers are looking for, but they don't always know it, and we don't always know it, and so we become self-conscious and intimidated. And we think that what we have really isn't quite what they want. They think they're looking for something else. What they're looking for is that Made Right sandwich. That's what they're looking for. They just don't know yet because they haven't ever tasted it before. I tasted it for the first time last night. And, you know, it's pretty good. So it's understanding, not being intimidated, just because someone hasn't tasted it yet. So how can you find out what someone's felt need is? Paul Yonggi Cho, pastor, I actually don't know if he's still the senior pastor. Yeah, I mean, didn't double check. But he has been the pastor of the world's largest church in Seoul, South Korea. When I heard him speak, at that time his congregation had 700,000 people in the congregation. in his church, active participants in his congregation, 700,000. When I heard him speak, he said that he felt like God had birthed in him a vision for 1 million people to be a part of his congregation. We're going to talk later about some of his methods for getting there, having to do with small groups. But this is something that he talked about. He encouraged his congregation to be aware of the felt needs of others. And how do you be aware? It's a term that he called holy eavesdropping. Holy eavesdropping. What did he mean by that? Well, he used an illustration of standing in the grocery store, and you're standing there in line, and you hear somebody in front of you. Actually, this is a little literal illustration. A woman in his church who heard somebody in front of him, in front of her, talking about how their marriage had just fallen apart and how devastated she was by the crisis that was going on in their marriage. She overheard that. I don't know if the person was on their cell phone or what they were, but they were saying that. She overheard that. And so she quickly ran out into the parking lot, caught up with this woman and said, "You know, I'm sorry, I just couldn't help but overhear what you were saying about your marriage. And I just wanted you to know that I cared and that I'll be praying for you." And this woman just stopped in her tracks, stared at her, you know, jaw dropped open, and said, "Thank you," and proceeded to tell her just a little bit more about her story. And the first person asked a couple more just simple questions and then said, "Hey, you know, would you be interested in getting together for tea?" And this other woman just said, "Yes." And they got together for tea the next day and proceeded to share more of their life story. And bottom line, long story short, this other woman ends up giving her heart to the Lord. Holy eavesdropping. It's not being snoopy. There's stuff that you already know. It's being willing to own it. It's being willing to confess. You know, I've heard this. Is there some way that I can be praying for you? Would you like to get together and talk? Can we go up to, do you have a Starbucks in Marshalltown? Yeah. Hey, can we let's go up to Starbucks and. Oh, no caffeine. Yeah, I know that's not true. But you got the point. Holy eavesdropping. It's being aware. It's having our antenna up. It's remembering that there is a gap and being willing to get down into the gap to see the need. Well, here's another key concept. Is that relationships are the super glue. Getting people in the front door of a church is one thing, but keeping them from quietly disappearing out the back door, that really is kind of another. Sometimes people have called this, how do you close the back door of a church? What is the primary ingredient that keeps people active in church? Well, guess what? It's friendships. It really is friendships. It's not the style of music. It's not how good, the preaching is. I'm sure your preaching is tremendous. Actually, I'm not going to get to hear it tomorrow. Actually, I have heard Manny speak before. Recently, and did a tremendous job. But it's not any of that. It is the friendships. It's the relationships that people establish. Statisticians have discovered that new members who stay beyond the first year in a church have made an average of 7 new friends in that church. 7 new friendships. Those who dropped out of a church after the first year made two or fewer friendships. There's something about that relational glue. Think about all of the stuff going on the internet today that didn't even exist 10 years ago, 5 years ago, let alone 20 or 50 years ago. But, you know, there's the match.com. There's singlekansaswheatfarmers.com. There's singleiowapigfarmerswhowantamate.com. You know, there's all kinds of... I don't know, I just made that up. But you know what I mean? You've seen them. You've seen the commercials. You've seen the stuff. And why are those things... Why are those still on television? It's because people are wanting connections. They really do want relationships. Relationships are the super glue. Ongoing personal contacts really can make a difference. There have been a lot of studies that have been done about Sunday school classes, small groups, and how do they grow, and how do churches grow. There was one man that I didn't know him personally, but I've read his story, who was... He always ended up teaching the largest Sunday school class in any church he was ever a part of. And he was a part of a business, a company where he had to move several times. And every time he would end up becoming an adult Sunday school teacher. And every time his adult Sunday school class would grow tremendously, not just from stealing people from other classes in the church, but I mean new people in the community end up coming and being a part of Sunday school class. And the question was why? What was going on? Turns out he was not the most gifted teacher. He wasn't a great proclaimer of God's word. I mean, he had, you know, good biblical things to share, but it wasn't that he was so dynamic of an upfront speaker. This was his secret. Every week, he contacted every person in his Sunday school class at least once. Usually by phone call, sometimes face-to-face, but every single person at least once a week between the Sundays. He had a direct personal contact with them, including any new visitor who would come. All of a sudden, now he's contacting them once a week. The relationships became the glue that grew his classes. Relationships. Two more. Oh, so here's the point. Practice being a spiritual relationship matchmaker. Oh yeah, should have mentioned this. Any of you remember Fiddler on the Roof? Yenta was the character who was the matchmaker. Well, how about this? Here's just something to throw out at you. How about ever thought of yourself of being in the role of a spiritual matchmaker? It's not the .com stuff. What I'm talking about is the new person that you meet down the street and you find out that they love football. Let's use our football illustration. And maybe you don't so much. But you know that Joe loves football or Brent loves football. And so you think, aha, I'm going to connect them. It's that being that spiritual matchmaker. When they show up at church, it's ask somebody new that you've never met, going out of your way, get out of your own holy huddle. You go over to them and you introduce yourself, you find out a little bit about them, and you go, oh, you know, you like kind of tech stuff? You know, interesting, there's a guy I got to introduce you to. Hey, Isaac, come over here. Let me introduce you to my new friend. They're just starting, and they love computers and sound stuff. You've got it. And then guess what? Eventually, you can walk away because now it's Isaac's new best friend, you know? That's the kind of, it's being a spiritual matchmaker. That is one of the most underrated jobs in a church. One of the most underrated jobs. Loving and serving is the vehicle. You know, we live in what lots of scholars and laymen alike have referred to a postmodern world. Well, one aspect of that is a belief that there is no right or wrong. I don't know how that confronts this part of Iowa, but I can tell you that that is a reality throughout the country, if not the world, that people are wrestling with. Is there such a thing as an absolute anymore of right and wrong? Words are hollow for emerging generations. They're empty. And the way to convince and connect with that kind of world is not necessarily the way that we used to convince and connect in the past. It's not primarily through our words as much as it is by our actions that undergird, that support the words that we use. So Robert Lewis, back in that Church of Irresistible Influence book, he said that our communities want real love, real action, real proof, not just the Word, but the Word made flesh. And then he said, a spiritual bridge always involves a physical reality. People need to see God's love to believe. So just a few minutes ago, we were talking about some of the bridges that Bangor Liberty Friends Church already has built effectively and that could build in the future. And we talked about food, talked about, you know, work, service kinds of projects, and remembering, oh yeah, to then establish the relationship that goes along with the service, and remembering probably in that to get to know them. Before people will listen to our message, you've heard this said before, right? The people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so it is showing caring, and a part of the way that we can do that, one of the most effective ways that you can show anybody that you care, whether it's your wife or your child or your neighbor down the street, is by listening to them. And as you listen to them and you listen to their heartbeat, guess what happens? You win a hearing. That's what we call that, winning a hearing. It means you've won the opportunity, you've earned the right, you've earned the opportunity for them to then listen to you. But it doesn't start there. It starts with us listening to them. It starts with building the bridge, the service, the physical reality needs to be there. Then we listen, and then we have the opportunities to share. Here's a last one of these I'm going to mention right now. And that is that transitions provide the window of opportunity. What do I mean by that? Well, the reality is that unchurched people are not all equally responsive to becoming Christians or a part of your church. Just sociologically is what I'm talking about now. That is a true thing. Now, some are quite responsive, and there have been lots of studies that have been done on this in church studies as well, of people who have not come to church, and one of the main reasons is because no one has invited them. I don't know if you realize that. It's not what we think. Again, it's not the music, it's not the architecture of the building, it's not the location of the church. It's because no one has invited them, is one of the main reasons why people haven't said yes yet. But there are other reasons. Sometimes people have been invited and they say no. Why do they say no? There are, sociologically speaking now, different times in a person's life when they are more apt to say yes to an invitation. In terms of national holidays, there are two when people are more apt to say yes. Already mentioned them a couple minutes ago. Easter and Christmas. Those are the two when people in our culture, I'm talking about American culture now, are more apt to say yes. Just because of there's media attention to things like that, and it stirs up some nostalgia for some, and they don't know how to connect, and they want relationships at Christmas, they want relationships, and so they're apt to say yes. There could be other times that are just like that. Some people like to watch the Super Bowl by themselves, but guess what? It is the number one party day in this country. You know the Super Bowl is tantamount to a national holiday? It is. There's more junk food is consumed on Super Bowl Sunday than any other day in the year. Well, why is that happening? People are social eaters. Do you know that? It's because people are having parties. What about having a Super Bowl party in your neighborhood where you invite your friends, people you don't even know yet, but they're your future friends, friends to be, you invite them to a Super Bowl party at your house to watch the Super Bowl in your nice new big screen. Guys, this is a great thing I'm sharing with you right now because what an excuse. But honey, we need this for our evangelism. Social dislocation, that is when people are open most to new connections. So watch this. There are some controlled events that are points of social dislocation. Marriage, divorce, moving, I mean literally moving to a new location, retirement. What are some other controlled kinds of social dislocation? Absolutely. And actually, you even might say that a funeral, a death, maybe is an uncontrolled social dislocation, but all the changes that happen, whew. What are some other either controlled or uncontrolled points of dislocation? Big time. Do you know that there are scores of people in this country who grew up in a church, quit going to church when they're teenagers or college age, and they come back to church when? When they have kids. It's not even when they're married, it's when they have kids. So absolutely. Good. What else? What's another transition point where people might be apt to say yes to an invitation? Or just a transition point? Big time. Do you know any hospitals in the area? Just kidding. Yes. When people have illnesses, that is a time when people are open to the gospel. I can't tell you how many times I've prayed with somebody in a hospital and it's a family member who ends up giving their heart to the Lord. I'm praying with the person with the family members around the bed and it's somebody else who gives their heart to the Lord. It's not just because they have a point of illness or health issue. It's somebody close to them having a crisis moment. Somebody, it's their mother who has cancer. That becomes a point of tension, strife, concern for them. Well, we could go on and on. Job loss would be another big one. So many kinds of things. Or job loss, new job, any of those. This list has been developed about stressors in life, and there's like a list of, I don't know, 40 or 50 things that are stressors. All of the things we've been mentioning here are on that list to one degree or another. Any of those kinds of moments are times when people are apt to say yes. So what does that mean for us? It means, and some of us might think, well, is that being disingenuous? No, it's being extremely genuine. It's recognizing when the fish are biting. Jesus said that you need to be fishers of men. He said, come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. And so some of you like fishing, you know that there's some times when fish are biting more than others. Why, if you are a good fisherman, why in the world would you go out to that lake or stream, whatever it is, when you know that the fish are not biting? Well, because I'm going to be a faithful fisherman. Okay, but how about also going when you know the fish are biting? That's not disingenuous. That is actually, in this case, we're not trying to kill the fish. We're trying to save the fish. How about it's not disingenuous because, why? We really do care for the fish. And we want to save them. That's not disingenuous. That is genuine care and loving. Being aware, they provide some windows of opportunity. Okay, well, we're going to have lunch in just a couple of minutes here, I think. Or it's going to be ready. But here's a question. What could someone, oh, sorry, I hyphenated this one. What could someone in Liberty Friends Church do to build new bridges, making connections that make disciples? We've already sort of been talking about this a little bit, but maybe some things I've mentioned here stirred up a couple of things. So back at your tables. We're not going to take long for this. Just 2 or 3 minutes. Is there something new that even in just the last hour that maybe has come to your mind that an individual, not talking necessarily corporately now, this is the difference, talking about that an individual who is a part of this church could do to build some bridges? I'm going to give you, maybe 3 minutes to talk about this. Okay, you guys are doing a great job of talking, and so I hate to interrupt this really good conversation because I'm just sure the thing I'm interrupting was the key point of the whole day. But maybe while you're eating, you can pick it up. Just before we break for lunch, I want to read just a very brief story. Any of you familiar with Bill Fay? He wrote a book called Sharing Jesus Without Fear. And it's a convicting, and you know how some books can be both convicting and encouraging? It's one of those kind of books. And he's got some really practical stuff in it, but this is just a story that he wrote that falls in that convicting, encouraging category, for me personally anyway. Let me read this for you. He said, "One night I had a dream. A woman clutched a little girl struggling to hold her child's head above the water. Nearby, a wave plunged a man into its salty depths. He choked for air as he thrashed his arms against a ceiling of water. All around, the ocean churned with drowning people, gasping for air, and desperately trying to push their heads above the surface. Their screams were doused by the roar of the relentless waves. Their cries caught the wind, but only in vain. They were alone in their terror, with no help in sight. Then a huge rock appeared, and a voice called into the darkness, and people began crawling up the rock's craggy sides to safety. But when they got to safety, something happened that drove me almost goofy. The people who emerged from the waves got busy. They got involved in building rock gardens, rock lives, rock jobs, listening to their rock music, and going to rock meetings where they talked about the people who were still drowning in the ocean. But nobody went back to the water's edge to help." He said, "Have you ever tried to run or yell in a dream? In my dreams, I can do neither. Yet I tried to run. I tried to yell at the top of my lungs, 'How could you have forgotten you were once in the sea?' And as I watched the saved scurry about their rock work, and as I listened to their rock talk, I realized the rock was the cross of Calvary. The voice they heard was Jesus, calling by the power of the Holy Spirit, inviting them to come and join Him. He's never high up on the rock where it's safe. He's calling from the ocean's edge, where the dead, the diseased, and the lost are found. And as you might recall," he said, "that's where He found you." And then he wrote this. He said, "Did you know that as few as 5 to 10% of the people in an average church have shared their faith in the past year? That means 90% of us have chosen," listen to this, what he calls it, 90% of us have chosen the sin of silence. Just like in my dream, he said, those who were drowning have gotten so busy and involved with the safety of the rock, they've forgotten to reach out to those who are still drowning. The rock. Jesus is the rock. He is our safety and security in the midst of the storms. But there's a whole bunch of people out there who are still in the ocean. And so what Bill Fay is encouraging us to do is to share Jesus without fear. It's to recognize that there are people for whom Christ died. It's looking at the needs from the in his way, what he's saying is, look at the needs from the perspective of the gap. In bridge terms, it's recognize that there is a need for some bridges. And guess what? There are some people that God has uniquely prepared you to reach by building a bridge to them. Okay, let me tell you what we're going to do after lunch. However, is our break going to be for an hour or so? Ish? Okay. An hour? Or what? Are you thinking 10-minute lunch? Or whatever it is, after lunch, what we're going to do is we'll take this one step further, and we're going to talk about, if you in the medical profession will especially enjoy this, or those of you who have ever been a mother, we're going to talk about this next step of building bridges, but specifically multiplication epidurals. Multiplication epidurals, giving birth without pain, and other myths. That's what we're going to talk about in the next session.